This recording is brought to you by listenupnorth.com.
This chapter is about Queenie, who we heard about in the first chapter, and it's called Queenie and the Waterman. Queenie's hat was always cocked at a cheeky angle. She was very particular about her appearance. Her eye embraced those about her with frank confidence. She was extravagant with her perfume, this month Rive Gauche, next month Je T'adore, gifts from her niece Janine, who was a flight attendant. Janine kept her auntie supplied with perfume and with the liquor for her glass-fronted cocktail cabinet with a let-down shelf. The interior light, such an innovation when Queenie bought it in the 60s, did not work now, and the mirrors and glass shelves were rarely dusted. The first time the bad thing happened, Queenie committed herself voluntarily to hospital. She praised the nurses and the psychiatrist for their close care, despite her stifled resentment at their calling her Queenie, not Miss Pickering. Queenie was a nice name, to be sure, acquired by her at the age of 6 when she was May Queen in her village. After that, she'd abandoned her given name of Vivian forever. But only Janine and 2 or 3 old friends were now allowed to call her Queenie. To everybody else, she was always Miss Pickering. The world called her Miss Pickering. 2 generations of schoolchildren in her village called her Miss Pickering. Even when 2 of them, grown up now and equipped with mobile phones and Ford escorts, came upon her one midnight walking through the woodland, clad only in her petticoat and armour-like brassiere, muttering the lines from the poet John Clare, even those 2 likely lads called her Miss Pickering. It was the lad's kindness in distress which made her, that first time, decide she must seek help at the hospital. In the hospital, the doctor gave her some pills so that when she got back home, she no longer saw the waterman rising, dripping pondweed and silvery fish, fairies dancing on his shoulders. The waterman who smelled of almonds and honey wine. It was quite a while before she decided to leave off the pills, just for a day or so. That was when she sat back, walked around, and waited for the sparkle to come back into her life, for the waterman to stride the earth again. She put on her hat at a cocky angle, splashed herself with Je T'adore, and set forth. Ah, wonderful! The colours were brighter, the noises were louder, more differentiated. People swept by her in warm beams of light. The buses roared and took on the aspect of scarlet tigers. The cars were insects, bright as jewels. As she exclaimed and laughed at all the beauty, people on the pavement gave her a very wide berth. She began to go further and further afield, to drink in all the beauty, to allow the great ones to come before her. She would return to the little house later and later. Even then she would be just about ready to get into bed when the beauty of the world outside would call her again, and she just had to get up and go outside to bathe in its light. One night Queenie was actually in bed when some lines from the lovely Browning poem popped into her head. Thou soul explorest, though in a trembling rapture, space immeasurable, shrubs turn trees, trees that touch heaven, support its frieze, studded with moon and sun and stars. She chanted the words again and again, racing through her back door, through the wicket space in her fence, on towards the woodland, trees that touch heaven. Alice Smith and George Onyet, returning from a late drink at the Green Tree pub, saw her figure before them, fluttering in a long night dress. There she goes again, Ally. George Onyet gave chase and soon caught up with her. Come on, Queenie, he says, his voice reasonable. There's no way to go on, no way at all. He grabbed her arm. She lifted her other hand and whammed him with her fist. Miss Pickering to you, George Onyet. Miss Pickering to you and to your father as well. He caught her hand in his tight. Come on, Queenie, he sneered. Queenie's good enough for you these days. That was when she brought his hand to her mouth and bit it, sinking her teeth to the bone. Howling, he let her go. She stood still before him, then looked at Ally Smith, who had caught up with them. "My name is Miss Pickering," she said. "You know, don't you, Alistair?" That time, Queenie was sectioned, and in the hospital they gave her the pills that took away her visions of the giant trees and stars and the waterman. She was meek, very good in hospital. She helped with the tea rounds, taught a young girl to read, and stayed tucked up in her bed all night. When they had a case conference, the professionals decided that Queenie Pickering was a prime candidate for care in the community, now not only fashionable, but compulsory. So her house with its cocktail cabinet was sold. In a rare soft moment, she had signed the lot over to Janine, her niece. Janine had sold it and gone off to build a new life for herself and her boyfriend Roger in the depths of Canada. But there was sheltered housing with a very kind warden. Queenie, for everyone called her Queenie now, Queenie could live there, and the nurse would call every week to see that she was taking her medication. Everything would be hunky-dory. Wasn't that how care in the community worked? After a week, Queenie walked out of the sheltered house. She put on her hat, not so smart now, put all her most precious things in 3 carrier bags, and caught the long-distance bus to town where they would not find her. Best to lie low, she thought, best to lie low. The gleaming waterman would be there. He was everywhere, so he would be in the city. And the sky in that place would be studded with pearly moons, the golden sun, and silver stars. And there again, the trees would stride the earth. Paulie Smith later was to write a poem for Queenie, and this is her poem. When bats fly at noon, and owls take refuge in the darkness, frightened of solitude, proud to be independent, with silver shields to hide their isolation. Paulie Smith.